Hi, welcome to the Bloom Podcast.
He's Steve, a clinical hypnotherapist.
And she's Susie, parent, cake baker and cancer patient.
And together we talk about different ways to get through tough times.
And meet great guests who share their amazing stories.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Susie.
Guess what?
Go on.
Quit my job.
You quit your job. Wow.
Well, I decided to become a full-time podcaster.
Was it the money or the fame that attracted you most?
It's the acclaim as I walk down the streets. I've worked there for 11 years and they were amazing. They were so supportive when I was sick and all the way through.
I thought you meant they were really supportive when you said you wanted to leave.
That's right. Couldn't support me quick enough in that one. No, they were great and flatteringly sorry to see me go. I mean, you don't stay in a job for 11 years unless it is a really good job. And I feel very lucky with the work I was doing and the people I was working with. Yeah, but it feels like it's time. And so here I am, one of the unemployed now.
Well, good for you. That's a big decision to make.
I probably shouldn't joke about being unemployed because obviously that's
too late
a
now.
Phrase that's...
It's in the can. We've got it now. That's our trailer.
Obviously, it's a phrase that's usually used when people are involuntarily not in work, whereas for me, I'm really fortunate to be able to take a little time and not have to rush into something else.
Mm.
So I'm going to bake cakes and I'm going to get fit and healthy and I'm going to paint the bathroom and I'm thinking of getting on a school committee, though I may regret that.
Well, you realize that you're recording this now for posterity and you can't recall it. So we'll be checking in on you from time to time, see how you're going with your various goals.
And say, did you bake enough cakes? After the experience of being unwell, of having cancer and going through the chemo and all the rest of it, something that a breast care nurse said to me before I had chemo was, this will change your life. Then I said, oh, in what way? And she said, oh, I can't tell you that, but it will. So that was actually quite unhelpful. And I don't know if she's still telling people that, but she could say instead, would have been helpful to say, I don't know, people see this as an opportunity, or for some people it changes their family relationships or their work or whatever it is, a little bit more structure around that would have been helpful. It sort of has changed my life in that it's made me really want to focus on myself a bit more, get healthy, have a bit more home time and family time. I must be the only person in the world right now saying I'd like more home time. That's all right. Everybody else is screaming to get out. But all of that stuff. So having the opportunity to take a break and a breather and rethink my life. I mean, I don't think I'm about to move to the country and get goats and start making compost or anything like that.
Well, it's funny you should say that. It's almost like we planned this because our guest today, as you very well know, is Jane Malik, who's done, I suppose, a more dramatic version, but not completely different from what you're talking about, to take a big change in her life.
Yeah, well, let's crack in and hear what she's got to say and what drove her to make that change.
Let's do it.
Today on the Bloom Podcast, we're welcoming Jane Malik, who's a yoga teacher and coach.
Amongst other things, but that's the main title.
Welcome, Jane. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jane, let's plunge in right in the middle. What were the signs for you that your life as it was wasn't working?
It was very much physiological, kind of physiological that made me listen. There were probably signs earlier. However, I think I'm quite a strong person and very committed and conscientious. So I think I just continued on the path that I decided I was doing, commitment to my work, commitment to my role as a mother, just commitment to all of the aspects of my life. But I was getting increasingly exhausted. And so it was really insomnia was probably the breaking point. And I pursued many natural methods, like with a naturopath as well as massage to support me along with my yoga practice at that time. I was a yoga practitioner, not yet a yoga teacher. It was almost like because I was at that stage 42. So it was my midlife body saying, you can't keep going like this.
That's an interesting way of putting it, isn't it? That we tend to think of, you know, some of the distressing signs of feeling exhausted, not being able to sleep, maybe with some people, I'm not saying with you, but perhaps depression, that we tend to think of those as being, if you like, bad things. And yet, I suppose what you're saying in a way is that that's the body telling you something needs to change.
Yes. And I think I knew it, and I was changing everything that felt that was in my control, including in my job. It was a full-time job, probably even more than full-time. Probably I was doing many jobs in one. And I, because of those signs and also wanting to achieve a greater work-life balance, I continued to request more time off. So I went from like full-time to four days a week to 3.5 days a week down to, you know, one day at home. I was doing everything that what was in my control within what I think was the system. But ultimately, my body was saying, you cannot keep going and you need to get out. But I couldn't hear that.
And what was it that made you realize you needed to not just manipulate the system, but to step out of the system?
Well, again, it was the health crash. So the insomnia led to quite a large rash outbreak on my body that when I went to my GP, she knew this is the next stage of a stress breakdown, an adrenal stress breakdown. Like insomnia is the beginning. And then if you're not getting that rest and the adrenals are not recuperating, then a rash, particularly in the lymphatic parts of the body, like the armpits, the groin, the elbow region. So I've seen a few people now have that stress response, that rash, and they've said to me, what's this? And I'm like, are you particularly stressed at the moment? So I didn't know that. And the GP, she was very good. She basically said to me, you need some time off. And it was at a particularly busy time with the project that I was managing. And my conscientiousness was like, oh, I can't. It's really bad timing. I can't, you know. And she was like, no, you need some serious time off. And she gave me 2 weeks on a sick leave. And it was in those 2 weeks that the enormity of the change that was about to come hit, because I think I hadn't realized just how stressed my body was trying to adapt in a situation that was actually, I want to sort of say insurmountable for any physical body, but insurmountable for my body because I'm so conscientious and committed to doing a good job. It was in the public service. And so I started to quickly see there were a lot of long-term public servants who just would sit back and just not do anything. And I'm just not that, you know.
So were you still in a sort of state of denial at this stage? Were you still trying to fight it?
Yeah, trying to, yeah, I suppose when you're really honest, I was not able to really listen to the body. And now, you know, almost nine years on, that's what I do. I teach listening to the body.
So that fortnight was a turning point for you?
Yes.
What happened?
I woke up one morning and it was almost like a light bulb that said, I can't go back. And I, over breakfast with my husband, I said, I've just started to realize I can't go back. I'm leaving the system. I cannot go back. And then we decided to move to the country. It was really quite a quick process. We've always loved gardening. We always imagined we'd move to the outskirts of a city and grow vegetables in our retirement. I just didn't realize that that would come at 42.
Was it a relief to you or was it scary that you're letting go of all of your security?
It was a relief for my body. My body went, like, did a big sigh of relief. My identity, you know, the identity and the attachment to my identity and who I am took many years. There were probably 3 to 4, even 5 years of a process of dismantling, or how could I say, maybe from through my yoga training and practice, rebuilding a new form of identity. What was one of the hardest things for me was all the hard work, all the study I'd done, all the experiences I'd had in many organizations, and my deep passion for good work and good organizations and good service that those organizations served the communities or individuals. And I'd worked so hard for, you know, 20 years of that career. So that was one of the hardest things to let go of. What was all that for? To end up now grow tomatoes, zucchinis, and teach 4 yoga classes a week and also not earn much money. So there was a whole mix mash of what is valued in the world. Am I valued? From the relief point of view, my body was like, oh, that's what propelled me, my body, knowing what's the right thing.
You talked repeatedly, Jane, about your body sending a different signal, as it, almost as if your mind was on one track and your body was the one that was able to spot and identify that this was not the right track for you. Mm. Is that how it seemed?
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. You know, I'm quite an intelligent woman and highly educated, grew up in a very academic family. So in some ways that was my upbringing. A little bit separate from, you know, sensations in the body. I think intelligence in my part and a very overthinking mind, very creative in my thinking, can go into overdrive, you know, which is probably a part of my nature. Like in workplaces, I gave a lot. I'm very quick. I could do projects quickly. I could build a strategy very quickly. So that's all very head, you know, very head oriented. Equally said, I've always had a deep love of yoga and body work. So that was always there, but it was like the hobby on the side. You know, so I was always in some of my workplaces, I would always meet the quirky, you know, you might say witchy people off on the side where we were into more alternative things, but it was always like quite separate. So head separate from body, PhD academia separate from body work and yoga. And now I feel like, you know, my early 50s now, I get it now. You can have a head, you can have a body. They can work together.
As a therapist, I remember one of the wisest pieces of advice that I was given by a, if you like, a mentor figure or someone who's much more experienced. And he said, with a client who's too much in her head, get her into her body. And with a client who's too much in her body, get her into her head. I guess what you're talking about, Jane, is actually finding some sort of a balance between the two where neither is devalued and both have their parts to play, but a different connection between them than you had before.
Yes. And I think all my life, I, even as a little girl, I think I was always very curious, you know, about embodiment. I mean, I wouldn't have known it then. And then, but it was because it wasn't valued in my family. And then when I ended up workplace or in academia, I would weave in what I could. In my PhD, I wove in a spirituality aspect that challenged some of my supervisors enormously. You know, so I think it was always there. But because the mainstream or the society that I was living in, family and then workplaces, and interestingly, particularly I think this year, the COVID year, so many people are awakening and a lot more value being put to all these things, which prior to this year, you know, like even growing vegetables here in the country, there was the diggers club ran out of seeds, the animal shops ran out of chickens, you know, the home hobby farm, baking sourdough bread, everyone wanted now their sourdough culture. So it's like all the things that I've always loved and done as a little hobby on the side all of a sudden became quite like almost survival.
Do you feel like the same person?
On a deep level, yes. And on the surface level, no. I've changed a lot. I'd say I've softened a lot. It's like that deep level has come out more. So that deeper level of who I am always was quite private. And a little hidden, sort of almost like a role to play in the world. So as that role to play dismantled, there was then many years of reconnecting rather than finding myself, reconnecting. But I would be very interested in some of the people who knew me. You know, that would be a great question I'd ask friends from the past. Do you see a change in me? And I'd need to have people who I haven't seen for a long time and back then and then see me now to really kind of answer that one, because I still feel the same and I feel happier because this deeper, more authentic part of me is out in the world now, is there. So people who meet me now, there's more authenticity. I mean, I didn't know it then. I thought I was an authentic person then.
Well, I guess the logic of that, though, Jane, must mean that you weren't.
Yes. Well, it's like a role. But as I said, there were parts of me that in my work roles that are your private and that your friends and maybe some few close colleagues know about you. I'm so conscientious, such a hard worker. When I came to work, I did the job. But there's so much more to me than the job. So a lot of people would see me as what I was doing in the job.
So what does your life look like now? I'm picturing a bit of the good life with yoga.
It is, but it's not so. This is where it gets really interesting. Everyone sees what we're doing here and it's so idealistic, you know, and it is on many levels. But I hope you don't mind me using a bit of French here. It's fucking hard work. I'm working as long a day as I did in corporate. We're at a bit of a turning point in our work now. With the last 8 years, what it's been. So pre-COVID, teaching 4 classes a week in my local town and workshops every other weekend and gardening during the week, admin and creating workshops. So very fluid with the season of the garden. We'd be very busy in the spring. We're very busy in the autumn with the harvest. Winter and summer are more dormant seasons where more work is done in my yoga business. And my partner's a shiatsu practitioner, so he's a health worker. And parenting, we're parents of teenagers. So they've just gone, finished high school now. So these last 8 years have been, yeah, a bit of a good life, eating all our homegrown food, instilling this in our young men, our boys, who now very much value seasonal, organic, fresh food.
You alluded to something shifting or changing now, Jane, the next step?
So over the 7 years as we've worked this land, we grow far more food than we need for the four of us. And because we're both practitioners as well as teachers, we developed over the last few years this seed of this idea of renovating the family home to be a retreat centre. And so we've started both the renovation as well as building the website as well as an educational platform for teaching sustainability, permaculture, lifestyle, health and wellness. So I'll be a teacher, Glenn will be a teacher, and we'll invite other specialist teachers. But it's like we've, again, laid the seed of this, but I'm sensing, it's interesting we're doing this podcast today because I'm sensing this side of me taking on again another really big project, and I have to watch that, the head-body balance. At the moment, it's too much for the two of us, but we're not at that tipping point of a business. Like we rely a lot on Workaway or Woofer volunteers to come and help. So it's a big project. And I'm just at the moment feeling after this COVID year, signs of that exhaustion. It's a really big project. We're going to need to collaborate. We need another model of collaboration. So we're at a point now. So it's not so ideal. Like I get a lot of people going, oh, look at this. And it's like, it's really hard work.
And I can see the dangers, but also this is hard work of a kind that you love that really seems to be suiting you.
It's a bit like, you know, when you're in an organization and you're doing a project and you've scoped it and designed it, and then there comes a point where now you need the staff, you need now the people, the human resources. And we're at that point. What I'm grateful for the COVID year is the awakening of people realizing this is actually a really valuable way to live. So there's many people now moving out of the city and coming to our area. The houses and properties are selling like hotcakes and people are wanting to learn. How do you grow? How do you make compost? And we've been doing it for 8 years and have run a few courses on how to build compost heaps, you know, because it's the basics. Like you have to build your soil health and then you can plant your seeds and you grow your food. So that's our summer project, is to start putting that out to our wider community to call in some human resources to help us.
I wonder if, Susie, given what you were just talking about, the compost heap, whether we should call this episode My Shit Life.
Or the transformation. See, compost is a transformational process.
I think mine's snappier, to be honest, Jane.
Yeah, you go with the title.
But I do take your point that it's part of the cycle and that life comes out of regeneration.
Yes.
Jane, if there happens to be someone listening to this who's got a sneaking feeling that they're moving into the phase that you started talking about, where that person might feel that they're decreasingly convinced that they're on the right path, what would be your advice to them? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to end up living on the farm surrounded by compost and chickens and yoga.
Yeah.
Their path may be different, but what would be your advice?
To remember that we always have choice, because that was the part for me that was the hardest. I would have left earlier. It wouldn't have had to have got to a crisis had I known there were choices. Part of the health imbalance, the physical imbalance and the stress response was that I couldn't in my mind realize there was choice. When I then realized there was choice, that was an incredible relief. You don't need to yet know what's the next step, but there are choices. And I think when we can feel very stuck and also very stressed, that can go out the window. And I often hear people, you know, who are sometimes in this situation and they say to me, I really know I need to leave, but I can't. and it's this and it's this and it's this. I mean, I was the same. I've got a mortgage. I've got this. I've got this. But when all of those fell away and the change happened, I realized there was choice, but we have to let go of things. And that can be very hard, I think, as humans.
I like that a lot. I've gone all thoughtful now, which has made me quiet, which is not right for a podcaster. I'm doing a little of this at the moment myself. I've just left my job after 11 years. Don't think there will be compost in my future, but certainly having some space, mental space, is what I'm looking for right now.
Well, maybe in another 7 years, Jane, when we're on episode 350, we might come back and see what's happened to your compost.
That would be nice. I'd like to, yeah.
What's growing now?
What's growing now, yes.
If people want to find out more, where would they go?
www.janemalik.com.
Great.
Thank you, Jane. It's been terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Did I ever tell you about the time I bungee jumped?
Wait, what? Weren't we talking about compost?
Go with me on this.
Okay, that's a logical segue from...
Well, my darling wife bought it for me as a surprise present, so I had no choice, really. It was the most terrifying 10 seconds of my life when you have your toes over the edge of the precipice and everything in your body is screaming at you, this is stupid, what are you doing, why are you here, get away from the edge. Then I jumped, and then at that moment, when I'd left the platform, when really I should be seriously worried, that all of my fear and my worry left me. And it was an extraordinary, I mean, the adrenaline didn't go away for days.
Is the analogy that's your version of moving to the country and becoming a yoga teacher or any of these major life changes that we've been talking about?
There is an analogy. I remember when I had an episode of depression, things weren't working out at work at all. And I felt stuck. I felt like Jane was saying that she felt stuck and that she didn't have any choice as to what to do. And for me, that resulted in a fairly severe bout of depression that gripped me. And it was when I got fired, actually. Again, when the thing that I'd been worried about actually transpired, suddenly all of the worry left me, I suppose, because there was nothing to be worried about happening because it had already happened. And it worked out for the best, as no doubt these things sometimes and hopefully often do.
And I'm glad, of course, though that sounds like a little bit glib in terms of how people, I mean, that's not everybody's experience. Depression is a horrible, horrible thing, and most people don't magically come out of it when a bad thing happens.
Yeah, of course, and I recognize that. And I wouldn't want to wish it on anyone. No, actually, that's not quite true. There are very few people that I would wish it on. It does give you a genuine insight into what depression actually is. If you've not experienced it for yourself, I don't think it's really, I didn't find before then that it was really truly possible to know what it meant. You kind of know about it in an intellectual way. But I do think, yes, and of course, it's a slightly glib anecdote. I mean, I've got some pointless, rambly anecdotes that don't go anywhere, if you prefer one that had no point to it. Most of my anecdotes are like that. For I saw Anthony Hopkins did a little piece to video just the other day because he'd been sober for 45 years, I think he said. Again, this sounds rather glib, but it did strike me that there's truth in this. He said, today is the tomorrow we were worried about yesterday. Or to quote that other great philosopher, Sam Johnson, depend upon it, sir, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. I'm fumbling towards saying that we shouldn't waste a good crisis. Into each life, some rain will certainly fall. And it's really more a question of what you do with that. I was just talking to a client today in my role as a hypnotherapist who is going through some pretty serious health issues. And she is using it to think about the meaning of the whole business, what we're here for, what there is to enjoy in the time that's available to us. The alternative to that is simply to be crushed by it and to just fall into despair. And I couldn't blame her if she did. And some people will, of course. And I never know quite what differentiates those who manage to turn a crisis into something productive as opposed to those who just get crushed by it.
When you talk about a crisis, we're talking about a sort of a situational depression or potential for depression where a person's in a bad situation and that drives them to the crisis point, as opposed to a depression that comes because it's an illness and because sometimes it comes and there it is.
Yes. Depression is a biopsychosocial event or process, which is to say that it isn't just a chemical imbalance. Sometimes it seems to be, and, you know, there may be something wrong that can be addressed, but very often, you know, we tend to think of a depression as being an awful, terrible thing, and it really, really is. I'm not underplaying that at all. But we tend to think that the depression is what's wrong. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes I think what happens is that it's rather like what Jane was saying before. It's the body's way of attempting to communicate that things just cannot go on this way, that this is literally intolerable.
Years ago, a friend described her depression to me. What she said was, it's like if someone said to you, you have to move house tomorrow. And you think, what do you mean tomorrow? Where am I going? How do I pack? I can't possibly. I'd have to pack up everything I live, everything in my home. I'd have to find somewhere to move to. I'd have to make all these arrangements. I'd have to get trucks. I'd have to tell people. I just cannot do that tomorrow. And she said that if someone said to her, why don't you go and brush your teeth? That was what she felt like. She felt this panic of, well, that is just not possible. I cannot do it. I mean, that is very debilitating, obviously, and you're not able at that point to start, or it would be very challenging to start reimagining your life if you're so destroyed by the illness that you can't even brush your teeth.
Yes, it's bitterly cruel because it's trying to send the signal that what you need to do is to act, to change, to make a choice, to change the situation. And the way that it seems to manifest itself is, as you say, that it makes any of the simplest acts that most of us do just about every day feel impossibly overwhelming.
I was quite interested in Jane talking about the ability to make a choice and how important that was. She said that at the point where she realized she could make a choice, that was what drove her forward. I mean, and sometimes people are in a situation where they can't make a choice as well. Like, I couldn't make a choice about having cancer. I suppose I could have made a choice about having treatments, but it's not much of a choice.
No, and actually that came up in the session that I had with the client today, because I said to her, you're amazingly strong through all of this. And she said, what choice do I have? And we circled back to that a little bit later during the session, because I said, well, it's not so much about choice, you know, and I'm not necessarily complimenting you to say that you're strong. It's an observation. You know, you don't choose to be strong or choose to be weak. You would like to be strong and hate to be weak. But one doesn't seem to have an awful lot of choice about that. Sometimes something about the situation that we can probably never quite understand why means that in a particular circumstance, someone can bear up, someone can get through it in the way that Jane did. Other times people are just so crushed by the burden that they cannot recover, or even, you know, even worse, may end up taking their own life because they just cannot see any other way out.
And of course, the choice that Jane had to make was a response to body stress, it sounds like, and pressure. So there are many negative things that can come down on a person, whether it be depression or stress or anxiety or...
Yes, and I suppose what I'm wanting to say is that if we can find a way almost to reframe what we're going through, and I know how hard that can be. I know from my own experience that I was not capable of that at the time till the situation actually changed. But in retrospect, the story that I tell myself, or the way that it seems to me that it actually transpired, was it was intolerable. And that's why it felt intolerable, that God forbid I should have been able to dampen down that depression to the point where I could just keep on going, because I wasn't really living. I was merely kind of existing and just going through the motions.
You describe that so poignantly. It's making me feel sad for you. It sounds horrible.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to say you're 15 years late. So,
yeah.
Do you mind me asking? You'd have been through some, well, we know because we've talked about it to some extent over the past year or so. What was it like at its worst in terms of, you know, maybe what I've just mentioned?
In terms of the emotional impact as opposed to the physical health impact?
Yeah.
Well, I feel lucky that I was able to respond to that illness in a physical way and not be too emotionally impacted. I've certainly had ups and downs in the past, but it's not always the things that you would think it would be. Yeah, I feel I came through the experience of having cancer without too much negative, I sort of want to say negative energy. Yeah, maybe I was just too busy dealing with my body and the physical things I had to do to go downhill. I don't want to say that either, because obviously there are a lot of people who do get a solid dose of depression or a lot of stress or anxiety while they're dealing with all of that. And again, it's not a
judgment.
No, it's not. I suppose it just hits different people differently.
It does. And I don't think anybody should draw any implication from what you've just said, that anybody who feels differently or who experiences differently is somehow lesser or whatever. It's just, I think it must be part of your makeup, because we've talked about this, that when there are things that you can do, then you will busily get to it. And that seemed to be of a great relief to you at the time, that there were things that had to be done.
Yes, that's the case. Even starting a podcast while I was having chemotherapy, not necessarily the most sensible thing a person can do. But I think that's my defense mechanism as well, is staying busy. And when I've had darker times in the past, it was almost because, thinking about it, I let my brain focus too much and sort of went down into a rabbit hole of my own thoughts.
Mm.
So staying, moving, keeping busy, doing things is how I manage emotionally.
Mm.
Wouldn't recommend it for anyone else. Pain in the ass. Constantly having to do stuff. There was a whole year where I just had my daughter, and she was a horrible baby. She was lovely, but she didn't sleep at all. She didn't sleep for 18 months. My friend passed away very tragically, and my father was sick and in and out of hospital, and then we moved house. Dealing with all of that was a big task, and there were things going on with my son as well, who was 3 and getting diagnoses and support and so on. Was there a kind of depression? Very possibly. I don't have a lot of memories of that year, that first year of my daughter's life. There are great chunks of things I just can't remember, because I know I was doing this, that, and the other all the time. I'm not advocating jamming your life with stuff if it's all bad stuff. I don't know, maybe we need to do another episode on how we deal with depression and difficult emotions.
I think so. There's plenty to be covered there for sure.
So find a choice and reframe when things are bad. It's one of the things I notice when people are made redundant or fired or whatever. For most people, I think they say that afterwards it becomes a great thing. It frees many people up and gives them that stepping stone that they needed, or gives them that little push to get out of what was a bad situation. I think that's quite a common thing, that it becomes a very positive thing that happened to them.
Yes, and we heard Jane talking about, in effect, finding a different yardstick by which to measure things. Many of us have begun to rethink status and money and what it's like to be in work and what work might be like.
So a year for making choices.
That sounds great, doesn't it? That sounds wonderful. Mm. If we can use the time to make some decisions and seriously consider other options, perhaps.
If that can be one of the things that comes out of the terrible virus period, that people have more options to work from home more and more choice, therefore, about where they live, then wouldn't that be a silver lining?
That would. Thanks for listening to the Bloom Podcast. If you like us, tell a friend.
And why wouldn't you like us?
And why not? We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at
steve@bloomcast.com.au or follow us on social media.
You're using my email address.
Certainly am.
If you don't like us, tell somebody you really dislike.